on this edition for Sunday, June 27th. The death toll rises in Florida's condo collapse. The U.S. government releases its report on UFOs.
There's a proliferation of white nationalist and extremist propaganda across the internet.
And exploring ways to counter domestic terrorism. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, the Sylvia A. and Simon B. Poyta Programming Endowment to Fight Anti-Semitism, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfein Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. The search for survivors and victims of the building collapse in Surfside, Florida is now in its fourth day. Last night, four more bodies were recovered. A fire burning below the massive pile of rubble and debris was extinguished, and teams began digging a trench to reach new areas. The 12-story condominium building collapsed just around 1:30 a.m. Thursday. More than 150 people are still unaccounted for. Today, officials said they are notifying families as they're able to identify remains.
As of today, one victim passed away in the hospital, and we've recovered eight more victims on site. So I am confirming today that the death toll is at nine.
The search and recovery work is continuing 24 hours a day. As of this afternoon, there were no signs of survivors. For more on the building collapse and the dangerous conditions facing first responders, I spoke with NPR correspondent Brian Mann, who is covering the story in Surfside, Florida.
Yeah, what we've heard from officials here is that they have actually made some progress. They've managed to extinguish that terrible fire that was burning inside the rubble pile. That's made things a lot safer and easier for rescuers. They're also digging this enormous trench that's slowly penetrating the debris, giving them more access. Unfortunately, so far, that hasn't brought news of survivors. As of the time we're speaking today, the confirmed death toll is at nine. Still, more than 150 people still missing and unaccounted for. So again, while there has been some progress technically there, the news has not been good again today.
What are some of the structural challenges? Maybe this might be an engineering question that the rescuers are facing here as they go into some of these tight spaces.
Yeah, they're talking a lot about that to reporters here, but also to families, because there is a lot of impatience, a lot of questions and frustration about why this isn't happening faster. And so during these briefings, what they're explaining is that this is an extremely unstable, dangerous site. They have to shore up the rubble pile as they move along. They say the debris is incredibly compacted. So as they move forward, not only do they have to make sure that the rescuers are safe, but they also have to be sure that they don't disturb any pockets or vacuum areas where survivors could theoretically still be. So they can't just, you know, barrel through here. They have to go meticulously, sort of step by step. To do that, they're rotating crews in aggressively so that people stay fresh. But from all accounts, it's a really grueling operation out there again today.
And what of the families now? I mean, what are the authorities telling them?
Well, what they're telling them in briefings several times a day is we're doing what we can. The mayor of Surfside, Charles Burkett, said today that family members had actually asked the Israeli response team that's arrived here, do you believe that officials are doing everything right and everything that they can? And according to the mayor, The Israeli team said, absolutely, you know, this is what we would be doing. This is being handled appropriately. And so, you know, they're trying to reassure family members. But again, this kind of waiting as the days go by, it's just the most emotionally destructive thing you can imagine. So much uncertainty. This disaster happened in an instant. And now the waiting is playing out over days.
What are the authorities saying about finding who's responsible for this?
You know, NPR has been looking at this. And of course, town officials and county officials say that they were unaware of this very troubling engineering report that showed that this structure was in very precarious shape as long as 3 years ago. What NPR has found is that at least one town official was aware of this report and in fact met with residents. According to minutes from a meeting that we've reviewed, that town official gave them the all clear back in 2018. So there are questions being raised about what kind of oversight there is, how these buildings are inspected. People are talking about possible new regulations and policies being put into place. And another thing that is happening right now is that the mayor of Miami-Dade County has instituted a 30-day inspection process for other older buildings in the community to make sure that other structures here in the area are safe.
NPR's Brian Mann joining us from Surfside, Florida. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
President Joe Biden is trying to clarify his remarks from last week that caused some Republicans to question whether he will sign a bipartisan infrastructure bill. In a statement yesterday, the president said he did not intend to suggest he would veto the bipartisan infrastructure bill if it is not passed with another bill known as the American Families Plan. He said Democrats are hoping to pass the Families Plan through a reconciliation process without any Republican votes.
But if only one comes to me, I'm not, if this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it. It's in tandem.
His comment that the two bills needed to come to him, quote, in tandem, surprised some Republicans who agreed to a bipartisan infrastructure deal with the president earlier that day. Republican Senator Mitt Romney said today he was concerned about Mr. Biden's comment, but is now confident the president will sign the infrastructure bill.
The real challenge is whether the Democrats can get their act together and get it on his desk. And I think the battle that's going on is not with Republicans. Republicans are going to support true infrastructure that doesn't raise taxes. But Democrats want to do a lot of other things, and I think they're the ones that are having a hard time deciding how to proceed.
Several Republicans said today they believe the $1 trillion infrastructure legislation will get more than the 60 votes needed to win approval in the Senate. A record-breaking heat wave continues to hit the Pacific Northwest today. People sought shade and anything that might offer relief from the heat. Temperatures reached more than 100 degrees yesterday in both Seattle and Portland and are expected to climb even higher today. Many areas across both states are expected to see temperatures 30 degrees or more above normal. With stores selling out of air conditioners and fans, cities opened cooling centers for people and animals to ride out the life-threatening heat. The heat wave is expected to extend into next week for much of the Pacific Northwest. For the second year in a row, New York City's Pride Parade was presented mostly virtually today. The event commemorating the 1969 Stonewall Uprising was broadcast live with some events pre-recorded. There were in-person events throughout the city, including Pride Fest, an outdoor street fair with food and entertainment. This year, organizers announced they will no longer allow law enforcement to participate in any of their events through 2025. Former U.S. Senator Mike Gravel has died. Gravel, a Democrat, represented Alaska from 1969 to 1981 and ran for president twice. During his two terms in the Senate, he led a one-man filibuster to protest the Vietnam-era draft, and he read more than 4,000 pages of the leaked document known as the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record. Senator Gravel died yesterday in California, according to his daughter. He was 91 years old. For the latest national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. On Friday, the U.S. government intelligence community released a preliminary report on UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, more commonly known as UFOs. The long-awaited report comes after the declassification and release in recent years of several videos showing mysterious sightings. And while investigators said there were no extraterrestrial links to the 144 sightings that were reviewed, they also said there was too little information to characterize the incidents, leaving a lot of unanswered questions. For more on the report, I spoke with PBS NewsHour science correspondent Miles O'Brien. Okay, Miles, so the big news, besides the new name change from UFO to UAP, how significant was this report?
Well, it takes it one step into the realm of conversation outside of the snicker factor, if nothing else, right? We're now in a discussion of how we can look for potential UAPs or UFOs. I still like UFO. We can start to look at them for them in a more concerted way, using things like, you know, artificial intelligence and pattern recognition, taking, you know, radar data from all over the country and trying to look for anomalies rather than just relying on, you know, what amounts to gun sight data from military aircraft.
You know, in the report, they posed a few possible reasons that some of these could have happened. I mean, maybe some of it is science, a refraction of light and water. I mean, they had a few different theories in there.
They did, and they certainly were trying to, you know, cover all the bases, as it were. But what really struck me the most were the ones where they said, you know, we had multiple and varied sensors all returning the same information. You know, anytime you get involved in any aspect of science or technology, and you get separate streams of data that check out each other, that's when you start saying there's something here. And that's what made it more than just a random casual, you're not going to believe what I saw when I was flying. There it was, you know, recorded with multiple sensors all agreeing that something wasn't right here. So then what is it? Is it something we've created in the black world and we're not sharing? They say not. Is it something adversaries might have created, you know, China or Russia? I presume if China or Russia had this capability, we would know about that. Probably by now. Hari, I am a guy who's seen one of these, okay? It was my wife and I at the time in the 1980s in Maine. We looked up in the sky. It looked like an extremely bright planet, like something like Venus, only even brighter, just hovering there. And then all of a sudden, it just took off at speeds that were beyond my comprehension. But now, what I saw is, it's almost identical to what we've heard from a lot of these Navy pilots incorporated into this report. So I feel a little bit validated myself.
Good. So here's the thing. This is just a 9-page unclassified report. I mean, it also lends itself to people saying, well, what's the government not telling us? It kind of almost fuels another surge of interest in this possibility.
You know, when you get a boiled down 9-page version of what clearly is something with a lot of depth and data to it, that is only going to spur on more of a press for more information.
Why doesn't the government declassify at all?
If it is, in fact, classified programs that the U.S. is involved in, I guess we understand that, but maybe they could nod to that effect or that fact to us in some fashion. I don't know. They say, I forget the exact wording, that this is not anything that the U.S. is developing in a super secret way. If that is the case, why hold back? Why not share it all? Why not lay all the cards on the table? Some of this is a bias toward keeping it secret, I think. But I do believe the more transparency, the better here. We need to know the full story. And I just hope that this continues on in a concerted way, in a more open way in the future.
Yeah. Miles O'Brien, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Hari.
Earlier this month, President Biden released the country's first national strategy for countering domestic terrorism, which he called a stain on the soul of America. The threat of domestic terrorism is not new in this country, but the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th has amplified the issue. Some experts say that law enforcement strategies alone won't stop right-wing radicals. They believe a better strategy is stopping them from becoming radicalized in the first place. NewsHour Weekend's Zachary Green has more as part of our ongoing series exploring hate, anti-Semitism, racism, and extremism.
In the 1990s, Germany was facing a surge in violent incidents involving white supremacists.
The skinhead movement came up, large-scale attacks against refugee shelters, for example, using arson attacks or just beating up immigrants or refugees on streets and political opponents. They tried to dominate whole parts of cities or even villages with that strategy.
Daniel Kohler is the director of the German Institute on Radicalization and De-Radicalization Studies, or GERDS. He says that while violent right-wing extremism had existed in Germany since after World War II, it was only in the 90s that public outcry forced the government to take action.
This was actually when the German government decided to put significant amounts of federal funding into non-governmental civil society-based preventing and countering violent extremism programs, mainly targeting adolescents, teenagers, the youth in general that were considered to be, you know, frustrated with a lack of perspectives coming from broken family backgrounds.
Since then, the German government has poured resources into public-private partnerships to prevent far-right radicalization from happening in the first place. Methods developed from these partnerships include teaching students about democratic values, providing mental health and job counseling, and educating youths on how radicalization works, such as in this play performed for German teens.
The target groups for these tools are usually teenagers, families, communities, social workers, mental health service providers, to educate them, to provide them with the necessary tools and knowledge to respond to a potential case of radicalization when they might come across such a case.
Germany spends roughly $180 million a year on its civil society programming. Kohler says that while far-right extremism is still a problem in Germany, the U.S. lacks the same infrastructure in dealing with its own right-wing radicalization issues. And 2017's Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, added a new layer of complexity to the problem of white supremacy in the U.S. Cassie Miller is an analyst with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Unite the Right really revealed the limits of mass mobilization and organizing through these mainstream political channels. A lot of the groups were infiltrated by law enforcement, by anti-fascists, and by journalists. A lot of them got caught up in lawsuits that are still ongoing, and that really, really hampered their organizing abilities. They didn't feel like the political system offered them the tools that they needed to create the kind of revolutionary change that they wanted to see in society.
According to a report published by the Southern Poverty Law Center, the number of hate groups operating in the U.S. between 2018 and 2020 actually dropped by almost 18%. But Miller says that doesn't mean white nationalists have become less numerous or less dangerous. Instead, many have retreated to online communities on social media.
It used to be that white nationalist extremist groups had to meet people in person. They had to give people their literature in person. And now the bar has been significantly lowered, and they can reach much, much wider audiences with way less effort. And what we're seeing is that there's a proliferation of white nationalist and extremist propaganda across the internet, and often on platforms that are really not interested in regulating the kind of content that people place on them.
Miller says that online propaganda can have real-world consequences. For example, the shooter in the 2018 attack on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh was inspired by racist and anti-Semitic conspiracy theories on the white supremacist social media site Gab. And the culprit in the 2019 El Paso shooting posted an anti-immigrant manifesto on the online message board 8chan minutes before he opened fire.
If you look at the kind of content that those attackers were posting online or the manifestos that they posted, that kind of content is all over the internet. And it's really become normalized through repetition. When you believe that, then violence becomes a much more kind of reasonable solution in your mind.
Even the failed January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol was fomented by online misinformation about the 2020 election. Some of the insurrectionists even used the fringe social media sites Gab and Parler to trade information on what streets to take to avoid the police and what tools to bring to break into the Capitol. In response to the attack, this March, the Department of Homeland Security made $20 million in funding available for local communities to develop programs to prevent domestic violent extremism. But that's still only 11% of what Germany spends annually on countering radicalization amongst its own population, which is just a quarter of the size of the U.S. In fact, just last year, in the face of the worst rise in far-right crime since 2001, the German government approved more than $1.2 billion in anti-racism programming over the next 3 years.
The United States is behind most Western European countries 20 to 30 years at least when it comes to building these infrastructures. You cannot just jumpstart them or kickstart them in a matter of months or even years. You have to build these networks, these programs, you have to build relationships, and you have to test really how certain methods work in a certain community. And these infrastructures, they need to grow organically.
Cynthia Miller Idris is researching how to do that very thing. She heads up the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, or PERIL, at American University in Washington, D.C. It's modeling its methods for preventing extremist violence on Germany's.
They have models for how to do this in a more community-based way. And so a lot of what I'm trying to do is learning from those approaches and adopting them here in the States. It is kind of possible and manageable and something that you can be empowered to do within your own community instead of waiting sort of for the government to solve it, which is, I think, what a lot of people are feeling right now.
PERIL creates teaching and parenting guides on recognizing online propaganda and also produces videos like this one about a man becoming part of an online extremist group.
Misinformation about gun control was circulating wildly, including rumors that the National Guard was going to go door to door to confiscate weapons.
Their research shows that, on average, those who watched it became more skeptical of information on social media and alternative news sites, and more likely to fact-check news stories before trusting them. Miller Idris likens these methods to inoculation against disease. By teaching people about how to recognize far-right propaganda and misinformation, they can build up a resistance to it when they encounter it online.
It turns out that people don't like to find out that they're being manipulated, and they are able to then build their own counter-arguments against it so that when they do encounter it out there in the real world, they're able to have resistance to it. And once you see that manipulative technique, you can recognize it wherever you encounter it. So it works like a vaccine, right? It creates immunization or inoculates people against the propaganda wherever they encounter it.
But Miller Idris also says that the U.S. has a long way to go in building the infrastructure to effectively confront far-right radicalization.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
Finally tonight, our report on hate and strategies to combat it is part of the continuing series exploring hate, anti-Semitism, racism, and extremism. The reporting for this series appears here on NewsHour Weekend and on many other PBS programs and digital platforms. This spring, as part of this initiative, we've reported on Maryland's first-in-the-nation decision to start a truth and reconciliation process in an effort to come to terms with lynchings and its history of racial terror. And we've looked at the rise of anti-Asian hate crimes. PBS programs locally and nationally are also participating. And there is more original content online at pbs.org/WNET/exploring-hate. Up next is a new frontline film, Germany's Neo-Nazis and the Far Right, which traces how extremists have carried out terror plots and attacks on Jews and immigrants, infiltrated the security services, and what authorities are doing to confront the growing problem. Here's a preview.
They're part of a new wave of far-right populism.
Would you say it's getting more dangerous?
The frequency is higher now.
An alarming resurgence.
And you think there are possibly tens of thousands of people sharing this material?
Of a violent ideology.
Neo-Nazis beat me up.
And if your own policemen and your own soldiers are part of this scene, the problem obviously gets even bigger.
Frontline investigates Germany's neo-Nazis and the far right. Tune in or stream starting June 29th, 10, 9 central, only on PBS.
In the coming months, we will continue reporting on hate, anti-Semitism, racism, and extremism here on NewsHour Weekend. And we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can reach us at nhwetips@13.org. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Sylvia A. and Simon B. Poyta Programming Endowment to Fight Anti-Semitism, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.